The weather launches us into our first discussion on today's exchange, weather like snow. We expect it in the mountains in the winter, and so do lots of creatures, some of which change color in the winter, blending in with the snow. But if you're a white snowshoe hare and there's no snow, what was your protective coloring is now more like a bullseye. Our first guest has been studying protective coloring, climate change, and evolution all of a piece. Dr. L. Scott Mills is the Associate Vice President of Research for Global Change and Sustainability and a Professor of Wildlife Biology at the University of Montana. Thank you for joining us today on The Exchange.
Great to be here.
I want to let our listeners know, too, if something raises a question or comment for you, join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dr. Mills, first, help us understand, animals change color with the seasons. Are there lots of them that do that?
There are. There's 21 species around the world that have these seasonal color changes. And the interesting thing is that in some parts of their range, they actually remain brown during the winter. So for these 21 species, in some places of their range, they go from being brown in the summer to white in the winter, and then in others, they remain brown. And your weather forecast actually captured that perfectly for why, because there's some parts, especially along coastal areas, that don't get much snow, or it's real ephemeral, comes and goes, or maybe short, and for those animals, maybe a better strategy to remain brown. Whereas in areas like up in the mountains, becoming white in the winter works out a lot better.
So where the populations are pretty much dictates what the color is going to be in the winter?
Right. It's really closely associated with snow. So this is a characteristic, a trait that has helped these animals survive through the eons via camouflage. And it's really strictly tied to climate because it's determined by snow.
Are they genetically identical other than the colors?
Right. For the animals, the individuals that stay brown versus stay white,
right.
Yep, they are. They are. They're different at that trait, which is very interesting.
So do some animals do change color over the course of the year then? I mean, we're talking some will be brown in the summer and then white in the winter?
Right. So in your area, you've got, of course, snowshoe hares. You've got a couple species of weasels that are brown in the summer and white in the winter, but not all of them. And so some of your listeners probably have seen weasels or hares that are still brown in the wintertime.
Well, it's not like they go to the beauty shop. What causes the change in color?
Yeah, right. The change, it's triggered by day length, ultimately. So as we know, when the days shorten in the fall, that tends to herald the coming of winter, and that's what actually triggers the a series of hormones that changes the coat color from brown to white. And then in the spring, as the day length lengthens, which tends to be connected with snow going away and spring coming, again, a cascade of hormones leads to the molt back to summer brown.
So we mentioned snowshoe hares and weasels. I mean, does it generally tend to be mammals that are going to be changing colors with the seasons?
Yeah, it's Arctic fox, of course, are a famous one. There's a couple of beautiful, charismatic hamsters and lemmings that do coat color change, but also ptarmigan, which we don't know about so much in the central U.S., but in the northern parts of the U.S., there's ptarmigan, and of course in Europe. And so there's three species of ptarmigan, which is our grouse-like species, that also do coat color change.
And they live well up into the Arctic, don't they?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the case of snowshoe hares, it seems like they got a lot of the attention of your recently published research. And they're not all over the country. They're certainly in the northern part, and in the Cascades, it looks like down into California. So mm-hmm. Where did you study them on scene? Did you study them at the lab? Where did this go on?
Well, so I've been studying snowshoe hares for 20 years out in the field, that impressed upon me how tightly hares depend on camouflage to survive. So hares, we like to call them the candy bar or the cheeseburger of the forest. Every predator or everything that eats meat out in the forest eats snowshoe hares, and so they have a very refined strategy for escaping predation, and it really comes down to that camouflage. So we've been studying hares all over the Northwest, in Washington State, Montana, actually over in the East Coast too. But now we're starting to spread out. We're studying weasels in North America. We're studying a different species of hare in Europe, and we're working with collaborators with Arctic fox in Sweden. So we're starting to spread out, but a lot of our field work has been with hares.
I'm glad to hear you call them the cheeseburgers of the candy bars of the mountains, because I was struggling for a term myself, but thinking that they must be delicious because it seems like they get eaten a lot.
Yeah, that's right. Everything eats them. Yeah.
So yeah. Is this? I mean, it seems like one of their adaptations then is to be incredibly fertile. Is this one of the ways in which the snowshoe hare continues as a species?
No. So actually, that's an interesting thing. So I should point out that hares are not rabbits. So everybody thinks about hares as being like rabbits and having lots of reproduction, but hares are actually quite a different critter than rabbits. You know, rabbits do have this amazing fecundity. Hares don't. They have a litter in this part of the country of maybe 3 per litter, and they do that at most 3 times per year. And so that's pretty limited reproduction. You know, it's more like what you would expect for a cat or dog species in terms of total reproductive output. They're also, you know, rabbits are born underground, eyes closed, helpless. Mama looks after them. So they're pretty much shielded from predators in that first 30 days. But hares are born right where mom drops them on the forest floor. So and then mom looks after them just a few hours, and then pretty much they're on their own except for nursing. So hares are exposed to predators from the get-go. So it's another way that hares are shaped by predation.
Wow, that's amazing. Just a few hours, you say, then?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, if you think about it, all these species, if we go beyond hares, all 21 of these species, they're all prey. Even weasels, which are also predators, they also get killed by lots of predators. And so, really, what we've got with this coat color change is this remarkable trait that lets a lot of different species survive in a predator-filled world. And that's what really has gotten me interested in it, because it's a trait that's shaped by climate, and so the point of this recent work we've done is to say, well, if climate has shaped this trait, if climate is responsible and natural selection is responsible for this brown versus white color change, then how might we be able to foster evolution to continue to help species adapt in a changing climate?
L. Scott Mills from the University of Montana is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about coat color and adaptations to the environment that get put a little out of whack by climate change, it would appear. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Yeah, I realize where things get a little out of alignment here when you're talking about the change being triggered by the amount of light. Well, the amount of light stays constant. That's not going to change because the movement of the planet itself is not going to change. But when there's not snow around to match up with the season when there's not a lot of light, that gets things out of whack.
Yeah, you've nailed it exactly. And so there's two solutions. One solution is to have evolution operate to change the timing, to change the trigger, so that they become white later, you know, the trigger changes, so they become white later in the fall and they turn back to brown earlier in the spring. Or another strategy could be to dispense with the color molt to white completely and just remain brown. And so that's the key, is how might we be able to focus conservation efforts in such a way that we could sort of foster the ability of evolution to lead to these adaptive changes.
So this raises the question of how the species adapts in general. I mean, it seems like if you get a lot of white snowshoe hares in brown mountain environments, they're going to get eaten pretty easily, so they're not going to pass their genes on.
That's right. And so that's precisely how we would expect for the evolutionary change to happen. And that's one of the exciting things, is that, you know, we used to think about evolution as being something that was only relevant to fossils. You know, we taught evolution in the section of classes when we were teaching about the fossil record. But probably one of the biggest insights of the last 20 or 30 years in biology has been the realization that evolution, under the right conditions, can happen remarkably fast. It can happen on the order of 5 to 10 generations. You can see meaningful changes in body type or physiology or behaviors that allow animals to adapt. So these are real evolutionary, genetically based changes. And so that's what I'm sort of arguing in this paper, is that we should be, if we can recognize that evolution can happen on sort of ecological timescales, rapid timescales, then why not think about ways that we could focus conservation to help foster evolution? and realize I'm not talking about genetic engineering. I'm not talking about moving animals. I'm just talking about focusing conservation efforts to maintain populations that are large and connected, which is exactly the recipe that evolution needs to be able to lead to the most rapid adaptation.
All right, so I did have a question about the length of time here, and you just mentioned five or 10 generations, which for a snowshoe hare is what, 3 years maybe?
A generation is a year for snowshoe hares, a year for weasels, maybe a year and a half. So pretty fast.
So is your study data long enough to be able to track that? I mean, are you seeing changes already?
Well, we haven't been able to do that yet. We're working on that, and we also have some captive animals that we can do some breeding studies to see that, and we're also doing deep genetic analyses so we can look to see whether the genes themselves have actually changed with time. But that's all ongoing.
All right, so the adaptation could certainly happen naturally, given the room to allow it to happen. Are you concerned, though, about population crashes in the meantime as winters come with less snow and less cover for the white animals?
Well, right. I mean, you know, we've shown from our field work and our population work that if things don't change, that if there is no adaptation, that this increasing mismatch going into the future would, within 50 years, be expected to lead these populations to decline, because the mortality is really high for these white light bulbs on brown backgrounds.
Right.
And so if there isn't some sort of change, then we would expect to see population declines. But again, the point is that I think it's really important to say that this isn't some, you know, I think we do too much, well, this is a hopeless sort of thing or an inevitable outcome. And my point is that it's really not necessarily inevitable, that if we can help foster this evolutionary rescue, this could be a powerful tool, not just for hares, not just for coat color changing species, but for really all wild animals on Earth. We could use evolution as an ally to help get through climate change. So that's an important point.
So the concern does go beyond just the snowshoe hares or the weasels. I mean, because the fact is they are part of an ecosystem that would also be thrown out of whack if there are fewer of them.
Well, that's true. Yep, that's absolutely true. But, I mean, this idea of focusing conservation efforts to foster evolutionary rescue, I've been talking to people that study butterfly migration, and, you know, there's a genetic basis to whether you migrate or not for butterflies. Well, again, you could focus conservation effort on areas that have the rich genetic variation for migration as a way to help prevent problems with climate change. I've been talking to people that study sage grouse and West Nile virus, and really you could think about lots of different species that have genetically based traits that are shaped by climate, and if they have genetically based traits shaped by climate, then evolution could help rescue them potentially.
Scott Mills, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from the University of Montana. We're talking about protective coloration and evolution. So when you talk about focusing conservation efforts, specific to the animals you're studying, what would those efforts entail?
Well, okay, so what does evolution need to be able to make rapid, meaningful changes in body type or physiology or behavior? A, it needs variation. I mean, this is sort of the fundamental laws of evolutionary biology. So this isn't theory. This is, you know, these are things we know to be true. Evolution to operate fast needs variation. So I call that the special sauce for rapid evolutionary change. So in this case, it would be populations which you have in your area, in your listening area, where there would be individuals that turn white in the winter and that remain brown in the winter in the same populations. They would have that rich variability that natural selection could operate on. Second thing is populations need to be relatively large for natural selection to be able to operate quickly, and populations need to be connected. So the idea is to identify these special sauce areas with rich amounts of variation, and then to work to maintain these populations as being large and connected. And if you do that, then you foster the ability of natural selection to move the winter colors more towards brown in the winter. And also for those individuals that have those adaptive genes for the more brown coat, they then would be able to disperse out into other areas and begin the rescue process in the populations that turn white in the winter.
So as you said earlier, it's not genetic engineering. You're not talking about really doing much other than sort of standing back, but giving a further stand back with more room for this to operate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we know that these are good principles for conservation anyway. We've been doing it for a long time to think about how do we maintain populations that are large and connected. But we haven't really thought about evolution as being a relevant ally there. So the point is that by doing these conservation actions focused on these areas with these special sauce of extra variability, we're actually fostering the ability of evolution to help do conservation.
And do you have good solid information on what makes the special sauce areas special? I mean, are there things that are common to the places where you have good variation of white and brown?
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that was a big thing that we showed in this paper is that these we call them polymorphic zones. That just means two or more different morphs. In this case, it's color morphs. So that was sort of what we sought to do in this paper, is to figure out where in the world, for all these different species, are there places where the brown color morph and the white color morph are living together in the wintertime. And they tend to be places, again, that are pretty familiar to your listening area, places where the snow is variable across space and time, where some years it might come and go really fast, some years it might stay long time. And so a lot of times these tend to be more coastal areas. They tend to be areas that get a lot of coastal precipitation and then maybe have a rain shadow effect. And so if you think about it, over deep time, it would make sense in some years to be brown in the wintertime if the snow doesn't come or doesn't stay long. In other years, it would make sense to be winter white. And so in those cases, you'd expect evolution to select for both brown and white color morphs. And so that's been the solution over evolutionary time. But now, of course, there's this push towards more and more days without snow on the ground.
Is there a dominant or recessive gene relative to either the brown coat or the white coat?
Yep. We can say that there is a strong genetic basis for this coat color across all these 20 species. We're actually getting pretty close to pinning down that genetic basis. We're not quite there yet with snowshoe hares, but we can certainly say that there is a strong genetic basis. So this really is the kind of trait that would be under natural selection. It's a trait that matters for fitness because they live or die by their coat color, and it's a trait that has a genetic basis.
Let me invite our listeners to join us once again. L. Scott Mills is our guest. He's the Associate Vice President of Research for Global Change and Sustainability and Professor of Wildlife Biology at the University of Montana. He's the principal author of the report Winter Color Polymorphisms Identify Global Hotspots for Evolutionary Rescue from Climate Change, appeared in Science beginning in February. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I have to say the pictures that come with the research are compelling, the white rabbits in brown backgrounds.
Yeah.
What do you want people to take from these images?
Well, you know, I always like to, it's a great question, because I always like to show those pictures and say, really, this is a picture that tells 1,000 words, but it turns out that it's a pretty visceral reaction. You see those white animals on the brown background, and, you know, one person could quite legitimately say, well, that animal is dead, that animal is definitely going to get killed, and that species is going to be in big trouble. But another person could look at that and say, well, that's an animal that could die, but that isn't that natural selection. And wouldn't we expect then for individuals that have higher fitness because they have different coats to be able to survive? And so what I'd like people to take when they see these pictures, or even when they see these animals, which I'm sure lots of your listeners do, see these white light bulbs on the brown ground, is to say, well, this is definitely a climate change effect. I mean, there's always been mismatch, but there is absolutely increasingly mismatch as the snow duration gets shorter. So here is a very visceral, a very photogenic, a very obvious climate change effect. But the outcome isn't necessarily extinction. because evolution is a player here, and so with hard effort, we actually could help foster the persistence of these species even in the face of rapid climate change.
Let's take a call. We have Roy and Eugene on the line. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. This is a fascinating topic. Since you're mostly studying mammals here, I'm curious if you understand if there are any genetic similarities between these mammals and other creatures like moths and chameleons that change their colors very rapidly in response to their environment.
Oh, great question. Thanks for that, Roy.
Hang up and listen on the air.
All right, great.
Yeah, that is a great question. So that was one of our first issues we tackled, because we thought, well, if these animals could be like moths or chameleons or octopus, and they're able to sort of sense that there's snow on the ground or not, and just change their color accordingly, then that would be a quite easy solution. And lots of species do have that. We call it behavioral plasticity, or we call it plasticity. That is the ability of an individual to just basically deal with the environment by changing somehow. And that's a great capacity, and that's one way that lots of animals are dealing with climate change. In this case, though, we took a hard look at it, and really the initiation of the coat color change is really tightly linked to that photo period. And they begin the color molt regardless of whether or not there's snow on the ground at the same time of year, and they initiate the change back to brown at the same time of year in the spring. So they don't have that ability to sort of recognize that they're mismatched and not turn white or brown.
We have just a little less than a minute now. You mentioned variation, okay, large populations, and connectivity. I hear connectivity a lot, particularly with things like spotted owls. So we're talking about making sure that they do have corridors for dispersal and movement, I imagine, and not punctured by, you know, logging clear cuts and highways and things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and this doesn't have to be sort of a reserve kind of thing, or sort of a no entry kind of corridor, as much as just allowing, we like to call it, landscapes to be porous. So just thinking about how you can let animals move through an area.
All right. L. Scott Mills, Associate Vice President of Research for Global Change and Sustainability and Professor of Wildlife Biology at the University of Montana. The piece is in the February 15th issue of Science Online, a final version in the March 2nd issue. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
It was a pleasure.